Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Van Quick,
Moses Snyder,
Imran Siddiqui,
and Makula.
Guest co-host Alex Aussie KP, Foreign K Palix.
Can he hear us? Type to him, Dan. Type.
Oh, he needs his mic.
Oops.
That would be why we can't hear him.
If you yell just a little louder, we could probably hear you. Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. Now with 100% less water.
But he's with us in spirit, so how about 75% less water? I hear he's a Jedi.
What?
Along with 70,000 Australians and one Dutchman, all right.
And one Canadian?
Eh?
I'm Dan Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums, and with me is Imran Siddiqui.
Yay!
Who goes by something really original on our forums, I can't remember right now, and Makalua, who prefers to go by Mackie still.
And is 100% more caffeinated this week.
Wait, she prefers to go by Mackie still? Why did this happen?
Yeah, still Mackie.
Oh, Mackie, you came and did Polycast.
Oh. No, not with the Barry Manilow. And also, not with the singing. We've been over that.
That wasn't really singing, Mackie, so I'm okay.
Wait a second.
Wetter could not join us, but we do have a returning guest co-host. It's Aussie KP, who goes by Alex in something called the Real World.
Exactly.
The mystical real world.
So, Alex, is that you confirming that you go by Alex or that there is a real world or both? We should get clarification on that.
That was me confirming both.
This is episode 33. What's significant about 33?
There's two threes.
That's how old I am?
Oh.
What?
So this episode, like all others, is dedicated to Mackie.
Creamy.
So everyone have their topic lists? Woo, topic lists.
Topics? We have topics?
We talk about stuff?
What? Today in news, we discussed the Twilight of Arnor Beta 2, scheduled for Galciv 2. Also, we talked about Civ's diplomacy, great innovation, and Dan expressed horror that it wasn't ranked higher. Also, there was an Poulton preview of Civ Rev that was started, and I asked Dan a few questions. Dan answered them at length, gloriously at length.
And over in the modcast, we've discussed about how much we don't like the diplomacy hit you get when you refuse to help civs during wartime, but also what do you consider cheating?
In the Senate, we looked at the L and 3 W's, lumber mills, workshops, water mills, or windmills? Question mark. Then in a vaulted time machine segment, looking back on the first fan site known to preview a Civ title.
In the research lab, we discussed whether or not we should have political borders as well as cultural ones, and we said nay, and we also discussed ruins other than just being ruins, and we said yay.
This motion passes and this other one fails. I'm not calling you honorable member, though. You can forget that.
Oh.
News.
Stardog has announced a second expansion pack to its award-winning PC strategy game, Galactic Civilizations 2. New expansion pack is entitled Twilight of the Arnor, and it takes place shortly after events of Galciv 2 Dark Avatar.
Imran?
Yes?
Are you reading that from the opening post in the thread?
Yes.
Would you like to have a look at the date on that post for us?
Yes.
Oops.
It's that the second beta of the expansion was released, but it's true the second expansion itself has been announced. Since mid-October, Stardock has managed a publicly accessible list of their release schedule for this expansion, and Beta 2 was released on November 13th, just 4 days past its expected arrival. And what's really nice is that if you pre-order Twilight of the Arnor, like with previous Galciv 2 titles, you too can beta test the game.
Beta testing.
Your invitation is your credit card. Oh, yes. So, what is in Beta 2 over the first beta and the series in general? It concentrates so far, anyway, on specific changes to a number of the existing civilizations. First off, though, tournaments. Players can now compete for best score on very specific tournaments. Upon victory in a scenario, they submit their score to the metaverse, which they can then see how well they did compared to others. This is sounding very similar to the arrangement of the Game of the Week that we've been hearing from Sid and company over at Firaxis for Civilization Revolution. Next month, in December, Stardock will be hosting competitions with t-shirts and other goodies as prizes. No word if they will continue doing this beyond December and once the expansion is released, but it's a reasonable assumption. And there is now an additional expectation from Firaxis to put up some prizes for Game of the Week for CivRev. All right. I'm putting that out there.
Hooray prizes?
Yes.
Prizes!
Woo! Yay! Yay.
Whee! What's this gal saying now?
Something Imran's probably never going to play. Kind of like Civ.
Oh, yeah! That game!
Yes, that game.
Hmm?
There's also an updated technology tree displaying to users modules, improvements, and abilities they receive from researching a given technology comparable to Civ 4 as it is now, and the 2B CivRev. There are also, this is one of my favorite parts, revised planet surfaces, because in the word of Brad Wardell, the project lead and founder and CEO at Stardock, planet surfaces have always been a bit ugly, quote-unquote. Oh, what a harsh thing to say.
Just a tad.
We didn't say it wasn't the truth. We just said it was harsh. Apparently, this was due to Stardock deciding to have planets randomly generated each game, which in practice require immense startup time generating them and using a great deal of memory. But now, in Twilight, planet surfaces are created by artists, where the game then takes these surfaces and randomizes them to create a wide variety of planet surfaces. So as a result, you get a decrease in memory as well as faster game startups, all the while looking much better. I think just one word summarizes all that blather-blather. Shiny.
You know, that's all Dan cares about is the shiny.
This is true.
Did someone say shiny?
Yes, yes, I did. And then Mackie said it too.
Ooh.
And then you said it. So the all who's left to say it is Alex.
Shiny.
Shiny.
And the circle is complete. Otherwise, again, some updates to some civilizations that are already in the game. The Korath, who are an even more despicable offshoot of the already despised Drengen Empire. They have been reintroduced, and their technology tree is heinous, along with their special planetary improvements, quote-unquote, from Brad himself. They have a planetary improvement now that absorbs the life force from the biosphere of the planet to generate manufacturing, reducing planet quality in exchange for a 30% industrial gain. Wow.
Ouch.
Sounds like a good trade-off.
Between the Drengen and the Korath are their outlook in life. The Drengen want to conquer and enslave the galaxy, but the Korath want to conquer and exterminate it instead.
Well, that would explain their special power.
Elsewhere, the Taurians, their technology tree, focuses on having more quantity than quality, so Imran can appreciate this. It was only likely changed from default in this beta, but in the future, they will see their technology tree evolve. With a very high morale and high population, the Taurians are often the richest civilization on the block, but with the poorest technology. There's also the evolution of the Archaeans, or whatever they're called. We know I'm not very good with names. They get a new... What's my name again? Huh?
Huh?
You get a new technology called weather control, which enables them to upgrade their planet at a price. But no more details at this point. Sounds like a TBC to be continued.
Ooh.
Since then, the Beta 2 has seen the return of the Yor. They said they were going to do that, and they did. It is a race of cybernetic beings bent on wiping out all biological life they consider a threat and receive a variety of unique technologies. Kind of Borgish in their way. Again, I am showing my nerdiness.
Or Dalek-ish.
Par my what?
Dalek. Kill all humans. Destroy.
Oh, the Daleks from Doctor Who, yes.
I never say it right, sorry.
That's okay. It was adorable. The Yor, also the first race to receive updated ship textures. If you have a look at that thread, there are a couple of... or news items slash thread. There are a couple of screenshots of before and after, and not only do they look better, but they use only 1/8 the memory, according to rough estimates. Wow. It looks really shiny.
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 Elsewhere, the Taurians receive much-needed attention with lots of new technologies, planetary improvements, and more. All of that appears not to have materialized at this stage, as was indicated on the release schedule, were updated tournaments. Perhaps in Beta 3? And as for Beta 2B, the existing races are much more powerful than before, including the Archeans, which we've already mentioned, the Yor and the Terran Alliance, which of course are your plain old humans. And finally, Brad says, there will still be balancing needing to be done, but the clear direction is that the younger races are starting to become quite powerful in their own right. So, if this schedule follows, on December 6th, we will see Beta 3A, which will see the Corks and the Drath added, the Kryn will be added, and the Beta 3 on December 13th. Then on December 20th, Beta 3C, where the Thalians will be added, as well as the Altarians. Then in January, we'll see Beta 4 with a new invasion screen, a new victory condition. Ooh, a new victory condition. And on January 15th, it is the release polish of previous editions. So a very aggressive release schedule, if I do say so myself.
Civ 4 Diplomacy's Great Innovation.
No, I was speaking about Civ's Diplomacy Great Innovation, the original Civ.
The original Civ? Wait a second, what?
The original Civ, yes. Next Gen has posted a feature highlighting what they consider to be the 50 greatest game design innovations that shaped the video game industry. According to the author of this piece, Ernest Adams, the feature that Civilization really contributed to in the video game industry is Diplomacy, which he ranks as the 6th greatest game innovation of all time.
Uh-huh.
I'm also excited about that.
The top 10 innovations listed by Next Gen, to expand this a little bit, because some of them also apply to Civ, but I guess Adams just had to choose Civ for one of them. He had to spread the joy for some reason. Number 10, multi-level gameplay. Zooming in and out to any level that you want. Garcia likes to cite really early examples.
Well, because if it's great innovation,
yes,
you know, the early examples are going to be, of course, have the most impact.
He does distinguish between early known examples and best known examples, because just because it's an early known example doesn't mean it's well known. Doesn't mean it's any less significant, but...
Yes, because it says the probable first uses in Balance of Power, 1986, and the Civilization is the best-known early example. So, yes, he tends to separate out based on which game had the most impact with using it, even though if it wasn't the first one to actually do the innovation itself. That's number 10.
Number 9, there is the dialogue tree, scripted conversations. A choice of pre-written lines to say and the character you're talking to responds appropriately. First use is unknown, but the insult-driven sword fights in the Monkey Island games are well known.
Those were so fun. What, am I the only one that played it?
Yeah, I never actually played the Monkey Island games.
I played a demo of it once.
I would think another good example, a more recent example, would be Galsiv, the Galsiv series. Pretty sophisticated and quite humorous.
Oh, the dialogue during the diplomacies?
Yes.
Well, I was going to suggest Knights of the Old Republic as a good example. There's a lot of good conversation in there that can branch off into different directions.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that too. And also, I think Baldur's Gate, both of them. Especially in the end of the Baldur's Gate 2 expansion, because your ending depended on the things you said, not necessarily what you've been doing the whole game.
Number 8, smart NPCs. That's smart non-character players with brains and senses. First use, again, unknown, and modern sport games are cited in general for some reason. Number 7, mod support. Now, here's something that can be related to Civ, but in more recent years. So, best known example is Doom from 1993, but apparently the best early known example is the arcade machine from 1982. I've heard of Doom, but not the arcade machine. That's, wow.
You've never seen an arcade machine there?
No, he means an actual title called The Arcade. Try reading the topic. Oh, but mods.
But Imran's strategy has worked so well for him in the past. Why would he...
No. Read the topic. It says the arcade machine, which is like a construction set for arcade-like games. So I think they're actually referring to an arcade machine.
Yeah, but a virtual machine, not a real one.
Well, I don't know.
But mod support, not just Civ 4, but also Morrowind and Oblivion. There's so many mods for both of them now that I don't think there's two installs of Oblivion that are exactly alike on the PC. And actually, there's probably not two installs of Civ 4 that are exactly alike anymore.
Oh, and what was that? Wasn't it became Counter-Strike, but it started off as an expansion to something else?
Half-Life, I think.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably an even better example.
And we're missing a big one, Unreal. Because both the original one and Unreal 2 and all the maps that people make for Unreal Tournament.
Yeah,
mod support is awesome.
I'm really surprised mod support is as low on the top 10 as it is. The others are good, but I might have tried to stick it into the top 5. But okay, even though I'm not a mod person, you cannot deny its impact. Number 6 is diplomacy. I think Imran would like to talk about that.
Nah, I'm all right.
Number 5, leadership. And I read that and I thought, okay, I have my idea of leadership, a definition of leadership, which this author, Ernest Adams, again is his name, describes as the strengths and weaknesses of your people determine how well they will succeed at the tasks you give them. So judging their characters and abilities becomes a critical skill.
And they do Close Combat, which was a great game, especially for what he's describing. Fallout is also a good early example because your party had different ways of approaching things, and you had to give them instructions, and maybe they'd follow them, and maybe they wouldn't, and maybe they'd shoot you in the back. So, you know.
Wow, both of those games are so great, I can't begin to possibly talk about them. Yeah,
because Dan's never played them.
They're so great, and great-ish, and...
The Close Combat was fun because, you know, you might order your troops to do something suicidal, which in many RTSs they do, but in Close Combat, if they knew they were going to do something suicidal, they might just take off and run and be like, screw you, you're on your own, buddy. And it was an RTS where you could pause and give orders, which I like.
Number 4, avatars with their own personalities. No, that is not coming to the Polton forums near you. Absolutely not. And
our posters have enough personality
like
already.
It's like a Polton life.
I like this possible first use. Midway's gunfight, coin-operated, 1975. Wow.
What? 1975?
I'm trying to think of a song that has 1975 at the title. It would seem appropriate right now, but I can't think
of
it. No. No singing.
But I can talk about singing. Excellent. Apparently, the best-known early example is either Pac-Man, and he qualifies it if you can call that personality, or in Donkey Kong, both from 1980. Requiring the player to identify with someone different than yourself, increasing the dramatic possibilities in games enormously. Number 3 is stealth. Never letting the enemy know where you are. Quote, requiring a completely different approach from the usual Rambo-style mayhem. Unquote. Best known early example?
Thief, the Dark Project. More modernly, Splinter Cell.
I remember back in 98 when I played Thief, and I did get frustrated about it. I was a teenager. Maybe that explains it. But I was like, what the hell?
Splinter. Did that have Splinter from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in it? That would be interesting.
No.
Oh, shoot. The author of this article here on Next Gen Adams argues that not every game needs a story, but they're here to stay. Without a story, a game is just an abstraction, which can be enough to gauge the player, but isn't always. Quote, unquote. I like that summary. It says possible first use is, oh, gosh, alkalalabula.
You mean Alakabeth?
Alakabeth, I got it. Precursor to the Ultima series, or Mystery House, both released in 1980.
Mystery House.
And finally, number 1, exploration. This description here was kind of odd. An ongoing novelty as you enter unfamiliar areas and lets you make choices based on clues in the environment, quote-unquote. I'm not exactly sure novelty is appropriate in all cases about exploration. But apparently, the possible first use is Colossal Cave, a.k.a. Adventure 1975.
Looks like a text sim.
1975 again. I'll just make up a song. 1975.
Muting Dan.
I'm I'm going to open it up for any questions about CivRev from my fellow co-hosts, which will appear at some point in the written preview, but you could get to hear it first here on Polycast.
Ooh.
The Polycast exclusive.
Ooh.
Or the exclusive. A pre-exclusive. Ooh, pre-exclusive.
So, how often do you get those dancing bears?
Everyone's obsessing about the dancing bears.
Oh, may I also add, before you say anything, just so people know, on our CivRev forums, 2K Elizabeth, who is 2K Games' community manager, is answering questions about CivRev as well. So if you have any other further questions, you can post them in those threads, and I assume that she will answer them in due time.
Yes, thank you to 2K Elizabeth for joining our community. One of the other examples that we see are amazing acrobats performing. Military advisor at one point in the demonstration said that Prince Hector of the Phoenicians has sent us a gift of amazing acrobats. And we'd mentioned the Phoenicians before. It's just a minor civ. It's not a playable civilization. Before that, there are also strongmen pumping iron, tenors singing, but we don't actually hear them singing, fortunately or unfortunately, as your preference may be, and pastry chefs displaying their baked goods. We also happen upon some contortionists in suspiciously familiar tight clothing, fortune tellers, magicians hovering just above the floor and then taking turns and making some of their others disappear, and yes, dancing girls.
Oh, man.
Thanks to a bug at this point, produce some moves that are humorously not physically possible. Last but not least, we see some jugglers who individually or in pairs are juggling knives, flaming torches, and bowling pins.
I have another question. You played on the Xbox 360. How the controls on it?
Oh, the controls on it are quite nice.
Okay.
Actually, in the first part of my preview, I mentioned that, of course, Firaxis doesn't have any control over how the Xbox controller was designed, but how it uses what it has, important. It makes quite logical use to me how they use like the A and the B button and the Y button and the bumpers and the directional pad. It just seems to fit. Like, for example, with one click from the in-game screen, you can press the left bumper and it calls up the Civilpedia for you. You use a lot of confirmation of options using either the A button or the B button. It is true that in combat, if you're holding the controller, it will vibrate. It will.
That was Dan's favorite part.
If you're not certain about what a controller does, there is a screen right off of the start menu that will show you a picture of the controller and a nice diagram, and it points to what button does what.
Did Siv appear in the game a lot?
I did not see Sid himself appear in the game. He's not a barbarian like he can be unlocked before. We'll say Sid was in the game in one very abstract sort of sense. And I mentioned about a summary screen where you can see how far your research has been progressing, how much gold you have and how much gold is coming in, as well as your cultural output to that point, as well as how much culture you're getting a turn. In a screenshot, you'll see that, but I actually cut the bottom part of that off. I was wanting to save what you see underneath that for later, but I can mention it here since you mentioned about Sid. What you do is you see a little screen that says, Sid says, some quotable quotes from Sid that have appeared either in relation to Civ or even Railroads. They sometimes appeared in interviews. They've sometimes appeared in previews, and some of them have actually been from design meetings, so the likelihood that they've been published otherwise might not have appeared. Loaded at random, as evidenced by a couple of times you might get the same one, you know, a couple of times in a row. Some of them are common sense, such as a game is a series of interesting decisions. Some seem downright weird. A recent example from the Edge article, apparently Civ said, there is a practical value in a real causative relationship and visual feedback there. Sid quickly proceeded to say, I don't remember saying that. That doesn't sound like me. Other things off the wall, such as despotism is a perfectly valid form of government. Sometimes the thought just comes to your mind, kill. Said some of them are from railroads, such as, can we please have the passenger cars light up when they're occupied? And for the true off-topic being in all of us, consider this one. You're looking at the summary for your civ in the game right now. You see your science output again. You see your gold, your culture, and underneath it says, Sid said, Mr. T is a one-dimensional character.
That's great.
Essentially, every single time you turn around, there is something humorous. And the humor is not specific to one particular type of humor. I never saw anything that was truly offensive. Like, if you're looking for something that you might hear on some, like, R-rated movie, nothing terribly sexual, nothing that I saw, nothing offensive reference to drug or violence, but...
Just funny things. PG-rated.
Yes, PG-rated, maybe PG-13. Some of it's outrageous, some of it is... subtle. Some of it's just kind of like groan, but...
Speaking of humor, is the lowest difficulty level named the Dan Q level?
That's actually interesting bringing that up.
Oh.
I've actually taken a couple of pieces of audio out of the video.
No pre-settler.
What's that?
No pre-settler. That's
pre-settler.
Pre-settler.
No, it's not in Sword.
Oh, no.
I had to convince Sword to do it because he was geared up so much for the really, really hardcore guys. And Sword, like, what if somebody just wants to play it for the first time? So that's how he did it.
Pre-settler.
That's still cheap then for us.
There you go. To answer your question, there is no Dan level, unless we want to call Chieftain Dan level, but that would probably be too nice. Chieftain, Warlord, King, Emperor, and Deity are your five difficulty levels.
Mm-hmm. Did you start playing, I guess, from the beginning, where you chose your civs and everything and all that sort of thing?
That is correct.
Now, can you let us know if there is any word, is there going to be multiple leaders per civ, or is it just one leader per civ?
There is just one leader per civilization.
And how did the special abilities work? I mean, I don't know how much you were able to play, but did you notice any of them were overpowering? Or?
Yes, each civilization does have a special ability. They are in great flux.
Okay.
In the demonstration, Sid played as the Americans, led by Mr. Lincoln. Their special ability is they start the game with a famous person, which is a great person, but it's also referred to as a famous person.
Mm-hmm.
And in each era of the game, the Americans also get an additional special ability. There are four eras in Civ, Rev, Ancient, Medieval, Industrial, and Modern. These abilities are cumulative. They build up for the entire game. They don't expire as you move from one era to another. Also in the Ancient era, for example, the Americans get 2% interest on any gold they receive per turn. And during the modern era, the Americans get to rush their units at half price and get extra food from plane squares. I'll just pull out some specific examples from some other civs. In the medieval era, India receives the religion technology for free upon entering the medieval era. Yes, there is no concept of religion in Civ Rev other than the religion technology. That's just considered under the general culture heading, like it would have been in Civ 3.
Mm. Did you get a religion, though, anyway, or is it just considered you have a religion?
It's only considered you would have a religion in a very abstract sense.
Okay.
Anyone in every civilization can research the religion technology, and that's specifically how religion is addressed in Civ Rev.
Mm.
If you want yourself to think maybe before or even after you get the religion technology that your civ has a particular religion, then that's fine, but that's all under the culture banner. But I know, and of course, in Civ 4, for example, how different civs treat you, as we know, is greatly dependent on what your religion is or is not. What Civ Rev leaders will really emphasize is what form of government you choose. Now, I'm not sure the extent of that. I got to say that the multiplayer system and the diplomacy system were not working properly when I was there, so we didn't get to see either of those except diplomacy very, very briefly in the end. And I know in a previous podcast we wondered, is there a great spy unit in Civ Rev? And the answer is no, there is not. But there are spy units. Again, yes, they can steal great people. Mackie, Alex, any questions about Civ Rev?
I had a question about relics. I don't even know.
I would love to hear about relics as well. I will second Imran's suggestion.
Is it cool? Is it
There are 7 relics in the game. By contrast, there are 21 wonders. One of the reasons for relics, the motivation behind that, was to get people to explore the world. Fraxis has done a lot of testing with groups of people who have never played Civ before, which, of course, is the primary focus for Civ, in addition to being targeting console gamers. And they saw a lot of players who would just work the area that they found around their city, and they didn't want to explore, so this gave people a reason to explore. There is the Ark of the Covenant, which we have heard about before in name, but I can't actually now give you the specifics on what the Ark of the Covenant gives you. You get a temple or cathedral built in each of your cities.
And I was hoping the Ark of the Covenant would shoot out lightning and kill Nazis.
No.
Did you get that just one more turn feeling?
Yes. Yes, I did, and as someone who has not played a console in any considerable degree since the early 1990s, think Super Nintendo, and never actually owning a console, I wasn't really sure going in how Civ this would be, other than being Civ in title. I was very encouraged by the previews, but I was, of course, looking forward to playing it, as I'm sure many Civ players are, even if they say they aren't.
I really don't want to.
I said it. Some do protest too much. You're going to be able to complete a game more quickly, as has been said by Sid and Barry. I think that's generally safe to say. Of course, unless you like reloading a lot. I mean, then that would take longer, of course.
How long did reloading take?
And also the looks of your buildings have changed and things like that, so you get this real sense of advancing through time.
Try to cheat the lots of buildings in the cities.
Oh, okay.
Hooey, there we go.
Oh!
Later in the game, things get...
I see, that would be nice to have in, say, a pre-settler level. That would be great. You could just press the button.
Got news? Email news at apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy 369, Alexander I, or Illuminatus via Apolton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
Modcast time?
Yep.
Yay! Woo!
Welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Civ.
The first Modcast, diplomacy hit and refusing to help during wartime. The Rosbo 9999 wants, when a Civ is embroiled in a war, they often come around and ask you to go to war against their enemy. If you don't, you serve a big hit in relations. And basically, he wants to introduce a kind of a gray area here in which you can provide cash or gift units in order to help without actually going to war.
Yeah, when's it implemented? It is. It's just so ridiculous when you're diplomacy. You've gotten along with them the entire game. You refuse to help them one time, and all of a sudden they hate you.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's a good idea to just, you know, be like, well, we can give you 100 gold or something, or we can give you this unit, and therefore they'll still like you, but you won't be dragged into war.
Yeah, we'll give you 100 gold and call it humanitarian aid.
Yes, and then maybe you'll get a tiny bit of a drop with the other country.
Yeah.
Who'll most likely find out that you've given them stuff.
I like Roz's note that if you're currently at war with someone as well, another one comes and asks you to join another war, he's saying you should only get half the diplo hit that you would get otherwise, if you weren't already at war with someone. I like that, too, that the Civ could recognize that, oh, you didn't help us, but we understand that you're already stretched to the max or something like that.
Yeah, where's the understanding? We don't get any.
They should only ask once per war, I suppose, so you don't have multiple asks and multiple negative diplo hits accruing over and over again.
Now, Adagoth argues that there shouldn't even be a diplo hit for refusing when you're already at war, that there shouldn't be one at all. Eh, I mean, I know we're always talking about gameplay versus realism, and gameplay must trump realism at times, but I think that there should be a diplo hit, but it shouldn't be as considerable as it has been. That's, wow.
I agree, because then they might keep asking. I guess they don't want to fight. Okay. Now you hate me. Okay.
Or you get that thing going where you have a block of one religion versus a block of another religion, and everybody on one side starts asking you, and then everybody on the other side starts asking you, and then everybody hates you, and they all go to war against you.
And then that sucks.
And Rasbo 999 really likes the idea of the immediate gift of gold or gifting units. Hey, you know, the bottom line here is that with gifting units, there's actually reason to do that now. We'll tie into a previous episode. I like the idea that you could gift units or give gold and then not being drawn into the fray and being able to play both sides against each other. Ooh. And a good point that M. Barclay says is that the demand requires the player to declare war immediately without regard to how unprepared he might be. So perhaps an option to say, yes, we'll declare war in 5 turns or some other kind of measure that actually give you a chance to be prepared. But there was one point that he said that he finds really, really irritating, but I don't agree with. He says that being asked to join a war on another continent too far away for it to be practical or even possible for me to have significant impact. Yeah, in consideration of the fact that of the Diplo hit that you could get if you say no, but because it is so far away for it to be practical or even possible, what kind of practical consequence are you really going to have for declaring war? I guess the only exception might be if it's a really powerful civilization somewhere else, and you really don't want to have any reason to check them off, especially if you're not very strong power yourself, relatively speaking. But I've done that before, where I really didn't want to enter the war, but I look at the map and my level of technology and have a general idea of their level of technology and thought, there's no way I can reasonably get to them or they can get to me in any significant force. So I just say yes, and I get the benefit.
And then he gets amphibious assaulted 2 turns later.
Especially with the BTS AI.
But really, generally speaking, I would think that that would be a nice situation, that even if you don't want to go to war, you can just say, oh, yes, that's fine. And then it's just essentially a cold war for you and the player that you've declared war against.
Yes. Next topic on CFC, my new best friend. What do you consider cheating? There's a poll. Save and reload, Hina's Quasar Rush, regenerate starting spot, World Builder to add or take away anything, World Builder to gain information, World Builder period, none of the above, and the final option, I like pie. Banana is such a better joke option. But anyway, leading right now is World Builder period. Apparently, I guess it's a multiple choice poll, so 80% of the voters said World Builder period, and some of those also included World Builder to add or take away anything or World Builder to gain information in case World Builder period was not sufficient. Outside of that, save and reload got about 52% saying that's cheating. I don't know. I don't consider save and reload necessarily to be cheating. I mean, it's your own damn game, you know, whatever.
I like Derbus' short answer best, where he says, everyone here knows what the word rule means, so stop spouting out definitions of the word. A better word to use is ethics. Because save and reload is not really cheating, but one person might say that, well, it's not very ethical. But then as Solver says, it's your game, it's a single-player game. Play it however you like.
Yeah, it's when you're playing stuff for a tournament or other competitions, you really don't want to do save and reload, because that is cheating.
And then there's huge scandals, and tournaments become far more interesting.
I would say that as far as World Builder goes, to add or take away anything to me strikes me as cheating. I wouldn't do that.
If you're looking where people's troops are or which direction you ought to be sailing your caravel in,
But break up World Builder into a number of things. It really is a line. It might just be easier to just not World Builder at all.
Hands off the World Builder.
Randy, you talked earlier about that their pie option in the poll not being as good as the banana. Well,
banana cream pie option?
I have only one more thing from this thread, and that's the quote of the thread. I do this from time to time. When someone says something that is particularly striking, usually funny, and usually kind of octopic as well. From Paradigm Shifter, duh, I forgot to vote I like pie. I do, I'm not a weirdo. Huh?
Everyone likes pie. Come on now.
We next come back, bring pie.
Shall we move to the Senate?
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
workshops, water mills, or windmills. Ryopopia from CFC wants to ask questions about tile improvements, basically between the workshop, watermill, windmill, and he said they would seem lame and depend on future technologies, and do people actually use these improvements? Do you use them a lot, or just in situations? Blah, blah. Yeah. So, I build a watermill every once in a while. Sometimes I build it because I don't want to knock down the forest.
Lumber mills are good, too. I know they're saying they don't like it because you have to wait for an advanced technology, but once it does kick in with replaceable parts, you'll see cities that were maybe a little bit productive all of a sudden go to really productive.
True. It's looking ahead.
Yeah. It makes sense to leave at least 4 or 5 tiles of forest around a city, because if that city doesn't have hills or anything else, yeah, they'll be all food for all the way through the medieval era, but once you hit the industrial era, they'll actually have some production.
And because of how late the technology does arrive, relatively speaking, I would still get rid of the forests, and I would just look to have my city's population just be a little over 20, and then I can get specialists in there to offset the production that I would otherwise get from water mills.
Yeah, water mills and windmills I don't think I've used very much. But workshops are great for plain squares that you can't irrigate, because they really don't produce a lot of food until after biology.
Yes.
Which is way down the tree.
Yes, and I would, after biology becomes available, that's when I would then start farming. I would only have workshops insofar as I needed them in exactly the situation that you described. But water mills can also help make marginal terrain useful.
It's like tundra.
yes, tundra. Yay, water mills. State property nerfed workshop and water mill a little bit in terms of the benefits. You used to be able to get +1, but now you just get a 25% production bonus across the board. And that actually now makes me go for nation because of the +25 espionage points that it has. Again, workshops for me, just as was already described. Lumber mills on tundra tiles with forest, without hesitation. There's nothing else you can do with those except road them. And then if the tundra tiles with forest happen to be next to a river, put the lumber mill on there, you can get yourself +1 commerce as well as the +1 production. So that's nice. Windmills? My policy on windmills has been to place them on hills that do not have a resource to mine. I will gradually replace such tiles with mines already in operation, and as soon as I'm able to build windmills, I'll build them as default on hill tiles without such improvements as soon as they become available.
I guess a lot of it depends on how you want to specialize the city. Do you want it production? Do you want it to be farming? Are you stuck in the middle of the desert when you need the windmills for food?
For me, when it comes to production, I really rely in the later game on city improvements and specialists as opposed to what I do with my terrain for my production. I really emphasize food and secondarily commerce.
Fullerton University.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
if people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Fullerton.net.
Really?
Forums?
Wow. How could I figure that
out? I don't know.
Fullerton University. Sometimes I wonder. I wonder if I'm going to have to go back into the vault for this episode.
Might have
to. You may have to.
Yeah.
You have entered the vault where segments cut from earlier episodes of Find Relevance Later. From episode 6 with Dan Q and Imran Siddiqui.
Paul's on the first fan site to preview Civ game. What does that mean? Like no one else had ever previewed a Civ game?
No, it's not that no one else had ever previewed a Civ game. To the best of our knowledge at the time, no other fan site had previewed a Civ game, had certainly reviewed it, where we're the first fan site, anyone working at a fan site, to get a pre-release version. Again, it was multiplayer gold edition, but at the time it was sent to me, I still have the CD. Ooh. It was originally called Ultimate Civ 2, and if you look in Fantastic Worlds at the time it came out in the box, I'd have to pull out the box, which is on the shelf a few feet away from me, but
that's too
I'm not
far.
Doing that. I believe it was on the back of the manual or whatever documentation came with Fantastic Worlds was an ad that said Ultimate Civ 2, but they changed the name.
Ooh, this looks amazing. When is this coming out? that was back in 1998, December 4th, and I guess that was the start of the Appleton rise. There's a little screenshot that says, D, quick, please enter your new password. If I stare at this enough, maybe he'll type it in. I will control Polton. That's a long way we've come. I mean, I joined the site in November of that year, I believe, from the original Alpha OWO forums that Firaxis has set up. So it wasn't too long that after I'd been there, I guess, that this we had previewed the multiplayer gold edition. We've previewed many other games since. Well, I haven't, but I've read them.
So if you joined the site in November of 98, then looking at this preview obviously brought back memories of you reading it the first time back then, right?
Yes.
Research Lab.
Research Lab.
Also known as the Lab of Research.
I feel like a scientist.
Welcome to the Research Lab, where we explore game concepts or ideas that are not in Civilization yet, but they might be in the future. Suggestion to make borders in Civ politically based.
Not culturally.
Well, yes, except if you look at his definition, he's got kind of a barrier that it's culture-based before you discover the nationalism advance, and then afterwards you get the idea of national borders. He refers to them as real borders, not culture borders. I think that's a bit misleading term, real borders, because to me real borders implies more like geography and topography to decide borders, whereas to me what he's suggesting are political borders. People who signed a piece of paper and, of course, suddenly now you were blah or nothing before, and now your land is part of somebody else's. Thinking that there should be three elements of determining borders: culture, diplomacy, and military. So culture is before nationalism, so he essentially wants to keep it the same as it is in Civ 4, a similar fashion. And then after nationalism, you get the national borders, or what I say, the political borders, that are negotiated between any two Civs at peace. And that borders can also now be conquered via military pressure. His original suggestion was to have units absorb or capture territory by holding it for a number of turns. I guess, you know, like, possession is 9/10 of the law.
Squatter's right.
This is why this is still my preferred method. There are likely to be many other equally good suggestions. Yeah, that sounds to me like something that could be exploited. One was made by this DFI 666, where you flag the territory you want to take when you're at war, and then when peace is declared, the border gets redrawn. I really don't think you would need to flag the territory at all. I think you would just decide that during negotiations. Although, in any event, to implement what he is talking about, I think would be considerable, because I think there would be a way to interact where you could actually click the mouse and drag your borders. I don't think we want to get into, like, latitude and longitude or some other coordinates.
Well, not just that, but then you have to do that way and have the AI recognize it and see if the AI agrees with that would be beneficial to them, and I don't know how you can make an AI that works that well.
Yeah, how are you going to make the AI understand this? It's easy for a human player to grasp this concept, but teaching that to the AI is going to be really hard.
I mean, for multiplayer, it might work, but...
Yeah, that would be a great thing to have for multiplayer, because people do negotiate in the diplomacy-type games. Okay, you can put cities up to here, but no further, and it'd be nice to have a more in-game version of that. But for single-player, I don't know how the AI could have the concept of it.
In a multiplayer circumstance, if you had a situation where you also had civilizations controlled by the AI, that could also be a problem then, based on what you're saying with regards to the AI not understanding. Or if you had someone starting out and then they dropped, then the AI would pick that up if there wasn't someone else to jump in.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of where it was all human players, not a mix.
So you would limit it to that, okay. The only other concern I would have then is if you say, well, how borders work in multiplayer is now considerably different than how it would work in single player. So maybe the solution is, for single player, we put this task on Blake's desk and we just let him go for it, and then it'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to be real happy to do that.
But then, not only, as you said, is that complicated enough, but then he suggests extra restrictions. Oh, boy. I think you should be restricted to only asking for land which you have some cultural influence over.
Why can't you just demand land anywhere?
Why can't you say,
I want your land.
This side of the river is mine, that side of the river is yours. Stay over there.
Yeah, why not?
That's sad. I don't know about this culture thing.
I don't know. This whole thing is getting a little too complicated.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's becoming unfun.
Yes. I say we junk it. I'm sorry, Mr. Peace of Mind, but your 5 minutes are up.
So you can peace of mind a piece of your mind?
I did. I'm sorry, sir.
More generally, of course, I like why he says that he actually came up with this idea. And we could have probably assumed this, but he actually says, if people disagree with this idea, I could remove it, but I think it is a sensible restriction on border growth. First of all, peace of mind, just because people disagree with it, such as us, doesn't mean that you should remove it. If you really believe in it, see if you can address some of the concerns that have been raised, and I don't know if it's been raised in this thread about the AI actually understanding this. But you say you think it would be a reasonable restriction on border growth. I didn't realize borders needed restrictions the way they are right now. I didn't think it was out of control or anything. Do you guys think it was out of control?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe he was pissed off because another save got some sort of border closer to him or something like that, and he really wanted that resource or something. Who knows? Maybe it's a personal vendetta.
You stole my border, prepare to die.
Even Peace of Mind says this would require changing tile ownership depending solely on culture, as well as massive changes to diplomacy and AI. However, if any of the suggestions in this could serve to inspire a modern, I'd be happy. But yeah, I don't expect to see anything like this until Civ 5. Well, don't even expect to see anything like this in Civ 5 necessarily.
I think it'd be a little too difficult to do it in any respect, so I think that's an unnecessarily complicated layer.
Yeah, I don't see it in single player, because if you're playing single player, you have it in your head where you think your borders are. And if the AI settles over there, you go to war with them and say, no.
Uh-huh.
It would be a nice tool, I guess, for a diplomacy game type of thing.
Ah, yes, diplomacy from the mouth of...
Yes. Grows from a barrel of a gun.
This land is your land, this land is...
No.
Ruins other than just being ruins. Justy, I think, has a good idea here, which is you should be able to get something from ruins. One idea he had was if you went and harvested the ruins, you'd give a nearby city a hammer boost or something like that, or a culture boost to a civ, or something about using ruins for benefit.
I really don't see how you would get a culture benefit from clearing ruins, because I would just think ruins might actually be considered of some value. It's like, oh yes, thank you for clearing that up. It's wonderful.
Well, I think he means, like, finding an ancient civilization, there'd be tourists coming to see, like, ancient Troy or something like that or whatnot. Maybe it would initiate greater learning when you find ancient art and stuff like that.
Well, I guess I was just thinking, for example, if one of your own cities or a city that you knew, like, you actually raised a city, and then the next turn you, there are the ruins there, and then you go into the ruins, and then you find the ancient city of Troy or something like that. I mean, I suppose it's always possible because there have been examples in history where one city builds on top of the ruins of another one.
I like doing that.
Things in the ruins. That makes me think of Master of Magic.
For me, what you're describing, Imran, as far as the culture thing goes, I would like that maybe as a random event sort of a thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go. Random event.
If you haven't rebuilt over the ruins in X amount of time, and then you get something random like that.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Yeah, not necessarily finding another civ or another city, but, yeah, something.
I like Conquest also saying that, nice name, by the way.
Yeah.
Saying that, basically, maybe they could generate increasing commerce. Well, increase over time, maybe because of, like, say, tourism type of things.
Sure. I like the immediate idea of just cleaning up the ruins and giving a nearby hammer boost, just like clearing a forest. But then, of course, you don't have the benefit of using the forest that you could have. Whereas now, if you decide to leave the ruins there, as Mackie said, maybe over time a random event could be generated that it gives a chance for people to explore the ruins and they find something of significance. Or even otherwise, it can become a tourist thing. I wouldn't really be pushing for that to be a random event. That's not bad. Maybe you should have to connect the ruins. I know now if you build roads on a ruined tile, then the ruins go away. But connect it to your network, perhaps, and you could get some commerce. I'm kind of on the fence on that idea. That part. His Infantry 14 talks about what the tourism says. 1 century, 1 coin, 4 centuries, 2 coins, 1 millennium, 3 coins, or over 2 millennium, 5 coins. Yeah, you're kind of giving a benefit for sticking with it over time. I know one person could argue with the realism, well, just because something ruins are popular, people are know it, you know, and this year, maybe 100 years from now, it wouldn't be so popular, so it should go down. Don't be like that.
People still see Stonehenge. It's technically not a ruined city, but whatever. It works.
So, yes, Jesse, Not a bad idea, sir. Not a bad idea.
We like that one. That's good. You're thinking.
This past October, Polycast celebrated 12 months since the series' launch. Very shiny. A series of polls are continuing to give you, the listener, a streamlined and direct means to submit feedback on the show and discuss it with other listeners at the same time. In addition to ongoing conversations on favorite Polycast co-hosts, guest co-host, and episode length, that and polls on favorite segment, favorite extra series, and game or games to cover are also being run individually. You can find the links to these discussions and polls from the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net. Look for the survey section, or you can visit the Apolton community forum at apolton.net/forums and look for poll threads that begin with Polycast in the title. Keep on listening and keep on simming. Call in today.
301-637-659, 301-637-POLY.
44-020-7871-7659, 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
Log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net. The rarest tile and resource combo. This Vormir says, I'm pretty sure it's beavers on a plane. I just thought, beavers on a plane? Like snakes on a plane?
I've had enough of these bleeping beavers on this bleeping plane.
The sequel? This Kethar says, incense on a non-desert tile. It can happen, but it's extremely uncommon. I find it uncommon to have incense on any tile.
Ocean cows. I like ocean cows.
Ocean cows?
As you scroll down, Santa Duck says, ocean cows. We point out that may be a bug, but it's still kind of rare.
Micah Wu says, they're rarer than whales. Yeah, but you might actually want an ocean cow.
That's very true.
If you live in the United Kingdom or elsewhere in Europe and you are thinking of calling into the show as opposed to using our Skype account...
Yeah, right.
Since when did you call in?
Please note that our UK number has changed. Now, I realize because of this, we're never going to be able to hear from Martin.
Oh.
Please note that the phone number has changed, and the reason is the telecom provider that was providing Skype with this number, and Skype, us in turn, has asked that this number be returned. It was a London area code, and I think they might just be in a little demand. So we now have a number that's still based in the United Kingdom, but it is local to Birmingham.
Well, okay.
Okay, then.
There wasn't any discussion about this episode again on CFC. I blame Mathos still.
Damn that Mathos. Mathos stinger. Mathos freshness.
Are you Russian full of life?
Mathos freshness full of life. What?
Hey, Mackie, where's your no singing comment?
Mm-hmm. She likes me better.
No singing for you, Dan. I didn't include anybody else in that.
Apparently, Wiglaf says he lost it in his pants, but aside from that.
What? I don't want to know.
I wish I could find the comment. I haven't been able to find it. Back when we started, someone said that they didn't like our show, that we were full of sophomoric humor.
Hey, we are at least junioric humor.
And Herclitus says that he has listened to every episode made. It would be kind of pathetic, but I'm an insomniac, so it's markedly less pitiful than it sounds.
No, it isn't. It really isn't. Thank you for joining us for episode 33 of Polycast, official podcast of Fulton Civilization Site. I have been joined by Danius Q.
That be I.
Also by Makalua.
Hello, goodbye.
We were joined for a little bit by Ozzy KV. He did not discuss youth rights regarding Civ. I was disappointed. And I am Imran Siddiqui. We bid you adieu. Adieu, adieu.
Irona says that it was a good episode. Another entertaining installment at the level I've come to expect.
Wonderful.
Thank goodness some people's standards out there are low.
Phew.
date November 24th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV Warlords and Beyond the Sword. Copyright 2007, Apolton Civilization site at apolton.net.